This is the Creative Sports Podcast.
My name is Justin Peterson.
And joining me are Brock Rahm and Garrett Wright.
It's what all the kids are going to use. It's free. It's what Blackmagic does with DaVinci Resolve. They gave it away for free. Well, people are going to use it because it's free.
If you're looking to improve your work habits and bring motion design into your work, you're in for a treat today. John Dickinson is the director of motion graphics with BorisFX. This conversation isn't about focusing on the tools, though. It's about utilizing what's at your disposal to learn, grow, and make great work.
JP, do you want to clap on 17? That felt miles off.
It did. Well, we'll roll with it. Edit in post, right?
Don't think we'll need it anyway. We'll get it in post, yeah.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the show. My name is Garrett Wright. I want to start out with a big thank you to APM Music for donating the tracks we use on this podcast. Also, a reminder that this podcast is an extension of the sports creative community on Slack, so if you're hearing this and not a member of that community yet, you should head over to sportscreativeslack.com and sign up for free.
Today, we are very lucky to be joined by the one and only John Dickinson joining us from Australia. He has quite the path and background. One of the reasons why I reached out to John to have him on is because we have a lot of people who have a production background, I think, who have an interest in wanting to explore more in motion graphics, or at least add some part of motion graphics into their work. And John has been on the scene training for many years, and just a great resource of understanding how people learn and some of the best ways to approach the training and the learning. And he's picked up Blender as well, so he's keeping up with the time. So first and foremost, welcome, John. Appreciate you making the time for us.
Thanks, Justin. Thanks for having me.
Can you give us a little bit of a background? I saw that you started working at After Effects back in 1994. Can you give us a little background on how you got into creating content and graphics?
Yeah, absolutely. 1994 and 1995, I'd been living in Japan with one of my brothers, and came back to Australia to work for my eldest brother. He was at the time a sales trainer for pharmacies. So he'd go into pharmacies, and he would teach pharmaceutical companies how to sell to pharmacists. And this was in the early 90s when multimedia was, it was really booming. The multimedia boom was really taking off. So CD-ROMs and that sort of stuff. And non-linear editing had just sort of come to the forefront, and I'd been dabbling a little bit in Adobe Premiere, and I remember my first video was holding my hands up here, but making the size of a matchbox with my fingers. So my first video was a cut together video of my brother's wedding. It was matchbox size video, and I was blown away because it was video on a computer screen. And this was 1994, and I put a little graphic in the very front, just with my brother's name and his wife's name, and a little rose sort of floating down. And that was my first motion graphic. I don't know how I even did it. I did it in Premiere. But I remember doing it and thinking how exciting it was to be able to do stuff like that on a computer. And this was on a Mac LC3. I don't know if anybody remembers that, but it was like a pizza box. I used to call it the pizza box. It had like 5 megs of RAM, and I don't know how much money I spent on it, but I know that they were very expensive at the time. I know that we had a Mac 2CI. That was the only computer we had before the LC3, and that was like $10,000. We were involved, and we were moving ahead in multimedia. And my brother saw what I could do, and he invested in an Avid. So, and we're talking big money there. So he invested in
that. That is not cheap back then. That is a financial investment. Yeah.
Avid Express. So even just, I think, I can't even remember how many gigabytes of storage it was. It could have been 10 gigabyte, you know, ultra SCSI, and I think that was 10,000 or something like that. It was incredible how expensive it was. And I remember going to the resellers at the time, went to Avid and we went to Media 100 reseller, and we weren't sure which one to get because the battle was on at that time. And we ended up going for Avid Express. So I learned how to use Avid and edit his training videos for these pharmacists, for these pharmacist sales reps. And I did my first sort of probably full screen motion graphics in Avid, cutting together like split screens of news clippings and things like that, and changing the colors from full color to sort of like monotone, duotone, that sort of stuff. And at the time, I knew After Effects was around because I was interested in the whole area, and that was After Effects version 3. So I said to my brother, "Look, we've got to get After Effects because I can do more motion graphic kind of stuff." And that was the last motion graphics I ever created in Avid. Next, it was just After Effects. We got a copy of After Effects with a dongle. It was super expensive, the production version at the time. And I started learning how to use it. And that was, 1994, 1995. So it was 26 years ago. I was thinking about that this morning, thinking, okay, I need to remember how many years ago. 26 years. Oh, my God. It's just gone by in a heartbeat.
So how did you get into, obviously, you gave us the background on the pharmaceuticals and how you were able to start editing. Did you go to school for any film or design, or what was that path like?
That's a great question. Now, I left high school here in final year, in year 12, that's before the HSC. So I bombed out of high school. Didn't know what I wanted to do. This is the early 80s. Nightclubbing, full-on 80s music scene. Worked at McDonald's full-time. Didn't know what I wanted to do. I actually went for a sign writing job where I had to sit in a room with like two dozen other guys and do a quick test of how good you were at sign writing. And we're talking glass windows in front of shops, with a stick writing the signs. This is sign writing when they used to do a lot of that sort of stuff. Thinking because I was good at art at school, I need to do a trade. Maybe I should be a sign writer. That's the only thing I could think of. And I couldn't even finish the test. Like, I was looking at everybody else and they're just doing some amazing stuff. I couldn't even finish that test. So I walked out of that with my tail between my legs and thought, okay, what else is artistic? I'm good at art. So I became a ladies' hairdresser and did a full trade, 4 years trade in ladies' hairdressing. And that's just after I finished that apprenticeship. That's when I went to Japan, and I lived in Japan for a few years. Then I came back to work with my brother. So there was no real logical connection between doing a ladies' hairdressing trade and starting to learn After Effects, other than I was fascinated by, I was into art. I was good at art at school. I was interested in the pop culture of the time, and it just one thing sort of led to another. Sorry, can you clarify that question once more? I think I've gone on a tangent there.
No, I think that's great. What did you learn or pick up from going through hairdressing school? Is there anything that you still use today? Like, I mean, I've cut my wife's hair a little bit during the pandemic, and it's certainly not easy.
Well, I'll tell you what, at the time I hated it. I only finished my apprenticeship because I didn't finish high school. I was really driven. I thought, well, if you didn't finish high school, you've got to finish the apprenticeship. So I got the piece of paper, then I immediately quit. Funny thing is, many years later, after having kids and having been in computer graphics, which is totally virtual, I started cutting my kids' hair. And all of the artistic development I'd had over those years, talking 10, 15 years in computer graphics, actually made me a better hairdresser. I was much more precise. It's something about learning all that on the computer made me a better hairdresser. And I really enjoyed the physicality, the artistic physicality of cutting hair. So I enjoyed it more having not done it than I would have if I'd have just continued, because I'd learned about, precision art, I guess, but, working in art in a precise fashion on a computer. So I didn't really learn anything about from hairdressing that helped me in my current career, but I think it was kind of vice versa, funnily enough.
So to pick up from your pharmaceutical sales videos and where you took Avid and the effects and all of that that you created, motion graphics that you created before switching to After Effects, to get from where you were in After Effects then to when you started MotionWorks in 2005, doing a bunch of training, helping other people get up and running in After Effects, were you in pharmaceuticals that whole time with your brother, or did you start to get into? I think you ended up in sports in some fashion at some point.
Yes,
right?
I was with my brother for quite a while, probably about 4 or 5 years, but I ended up sort of separating from him and buying some of the equipment because he was going in another direction, and that's where MotionWorks started. But at the time when I started to learn After Effects, I'd always been in a kind of teaching role because of years of martial arts training and teaching. My other brother, who lived in Japan with, runs a successful martial arts school here in Sydney. I didn't want to go down that career. So I decided to really get good at After Effects and in motion graphics, that kind of thing. So yeah, I didn't go down my brother Andrew's path. And I didn't stay with my other brother, but I had all this equipment. So I decided to sort of, in a way, build my own company, although I didn't really know what I was doing at the time. I did think, well, I've got to start getting my work out there. So what I did was I took, it's another question you asked me before. I did do a couple of courses. I did a local course on how to shoot video and how to set up lighting and stuff like that. And I did a course at the Computer Graphics College in Sydney for desktop publishing at the time when I was working with my brother, working with Quirk Express and Photoshop and Illustrator. That's what got me into those pieces of software. So what I did was, when I'd done a bit of work in After Effects, I went back to that school and I showed them a bunch of videos that I'd crafted together in After Effects. And I don't know why, I thought I'd give them, I just give them a look and see what they thought. And they immediately offered me a job teaching After Effects. So I had some teaching experience through the martial arts with my other brother. And I liked teaching. So I started teaching After Effects at that school. And I knew at the time that I was using After Effects all day. I just want to use After Effects. I just love working in After Effects. So I just want to, no matter what job I do, as long as I can use After Effects and create motion graphics, it doesn't matter. So I was at that school for quite a while, and it ended up going belly up during the .com bust. It had a huge amount of investment in web teaching and web courses, and then we had the .com bubble. What was it, mid 90s, maybe late 90s, and literally overnight, the school went bankrupt. Everyone pulled out of the courses. Remember, all the companies were investing in little .com startups. Even the mining companies were buying .com, and there was a huge gold rush for .com stuff. But it obviously failed, and this school went belly up. So I was actually made redundant from that school, and I was looking for work. So I ended up taking the work I'd done up to that point to an interview for a senior motion graphic designer role at Foxtel in Sydney. So Foxtel is Australia's cable TV network. And this was 20 years ago now. And I went for the interview and I got the job. And I'd never been to university. I'd never done any formal motion graphics training. All I had was the stuff that I'd built up because of the passion that I had up to that point. And a lot of the stuff that I put on my showreel, in inverted commas, was just stuff I'd seen in motion graphics books and just tried to replicate. And I said, here's my work. And they instantly made me a senior designer. So I remember leaving that meeting thinking, okay, I got the job. Now what am I going to do? What am I going to do? I don't even know what taking a brief means, but every single job that I did in that role gave me the reference and reinforcement to say that I could do it. So each time I did a job, I thought, well, I did the last one, I can do the next one. And ended up, you know, being in that job for 14 years at Foxtel. And I left there about 5 years ago. So that huge period between being a hairdresser, going to Japan, coming back, and then, you know, doing all the computer graphics stuff, working with my brother. And then there was a huge period between then and now, 14 years of just working in broadcast and broadcast design. And during that time, building up MotionWorks. You know, I like teaching. So, you know, getting into recording videos and trying to generate some passive income through MotionWorks. And that was partly due to wanting to build up passive income, but also just wanting to share what I learned. I never said to anyone that I was an expert in anything. All I did was learn something complicated and then taught it in a more simplified way, you know, because it took me a while to sort of work some of this stuff out. So when I taught it, it kind of filtered it into something more simple to understand. And people often said to me that I just made difficult stuff easier to understand. And it was fun just to share my knowledge that I gleaned, even stuff just that day. If I learned something, I'd record something and say, here, this is what I learned. And that just built it up from there. And I've been doing that for 20 years.
I think one of the best things about the modern web and the modern internet today is, whether it's free or paid, there's a wealth of resources out there for anybody who wants to jump in and learn motion graphics now. You know, whether that's After Effects or 3D modeling, like we were talking about earlier before the show with Blender or Cinema 4D, there's tons of resources out there right now. Back in the 90s, I know for a fact those resources didn't exist. I was very spoiled. Even when I was younger, there weren't a ton when I was learning After Effects, but I was the early days of Andrew Kramer, you know, and that's kind of where I learned a little bit from. But back in the 90s, what was that like trying to learn a piece of software on its third iteration, where it was just, was it just buying books off the shelf? Did you have a mentor? What was that like?
Yeah, this was even before Creative Cal. And, you know, Andrew Kramer, Aaron Rabinowitz, all good friends of mine. Yeah, training was expensive. And mostly it was books. The first book I ever bought for After Effects was Classroom in a Book. You know, and I've got them behind me now. You're not on camera at the moment, but I've got books still here. After Effects Classroom in a Book, Chris and Trish Meyer's, you know, Bibles for After Effects. Those were the books that I think myself and a lot of people learned the software with, but also with Brian Maffitt's Total Training videos. You could never go past the 12, you know, the box of 12 VHS tapes. When you go to NAB and you see those tapes, and it was like, oh man, got to get those. And that was just a case of sitting in front of the TV for hours. But Brian's such a great presenter, and Deke McClellan presenting Illustrator and Photoshop. It was so beautifully presented, and it was like a show. You know what I mean? It was fun to learn, made it interesting. These days, anyone can get a camera and you get in front of the software and record something and put it on YouTube. But these guys, they knew how to present, you know, stage actors. And they made it fun, made it interesting. And that was the way I learned to use After Effects, just watching them over and over and reading those books and putting post-it notes in and underlining things and reading the manual from cover to cover, just to see if there's anything I missed. And the funny thing is, I still use some of those, a lot of those tools today. A lot of the things in After Effects haven't really changed, you know.
I was just going to say After Effects is a program that has evolved over the years, but it also really hasn't, right? You still have keyframes, you know, the principles of motion still work. So a lot of that from your early training is still applicable.
Yeah. If you were fast in the early days with After Effects, you can be just as fast using those features now. You know, keyboard shortcuts. And I even put some training out a couple of years back. Didn't do great because I think my marketing wasn't great when I named it Weight Loss for After Effects, meaning weight as in W-A-I-T, not W-E-I-G-H-T. So working faster in After Effects, which is probably what I should have called it. It was interesting to go and dig right through the software and through the manuals again and make sure I hadn't missed anything and show all the little shortcuts and faster ways of using After Effects. And I was surprised, yeah, definitely how much hasn't changed.
When you talk about your training and different tutorials that you've created, do you feed off of people's questions?
I will base my tutorials mainly on, these days, stuff that I have learned. For example, I did a tutorial, which I put on my YouTube channel, on how to use UDIMs in Redshift. So for anyone who doesn't know, UDIMs are a technique in 3D texturing for working with larger resolution textures. And when you unwrap a 3D model. And After Effects in its current form, sorry, Cinema 4D in its current form doesn't support UDIMs effectively, but Redshift does. So Redshift for Cinema 4D does. And I had to dig through a whole bunch of information and tutorials, other people's tutorials, and try and work out how to use it and test it and work out the workflow. And when I did get it right, I recorded a tutorial about it. But I did that not only for other people, I did it for myself because I don't do a lot of texturing and UV unwrapping. I do a lot of modeling in my spare time, but my work at Boris Effects is more motion graphics. I do some 3D. So I forget how to do things. So I record detailed tutorials to reference myself. And I know there's other creatives that record tutorials that do exactly the same thing. Someone tweeted out the other day, is it strange that I record tutorials for myself? So yeah, I definitely find myself looking at my own tutorials. So I record them for myself and for other people. And, you know, everybody wins. I benefit from it and other people can learn from it. But as far as sending beginners to other places, I had a guy ask me a question just yesterday about Cinema 4D from an old tutorial on my website. He asked me some particular technique, why something wasn't working. And I knew the answer, so I quickly just tweeted it, just sent him a message back through the comments on YouTube. And then he got back to me saying, I'm a 3D beginner. This was a bit complicated for me. Where can I learn the basics? And my first thought is, you're on YouTube, just type in Cinema 4D basics. You know what I mean? There's plenty of training on YouTube. There's some really good training and there's some not so good training. But finding the longer form training for free on YouTube is pretty difficult. It's not really around. So you'd really have to look out for the longer form training that's usually for sale, you know, on Gumroad. Gumroad has training. It's a lot cheaper than it used to be. I bought some training for Blender recently and it's, you know, 5 or 6 hours of training was $60, you know. So yeah, definitely finding training on YouTube, but harder to find longer form for a beginner where you start at A, you know, you go A through to Z. A lot of training on YouTube is just like specific individual, you know, techniques. Very difficult for a beginner who's really got no concept of 3D. Although now having switched to Blender, there's a wealth of Blender training out there. There's tons of basic Blender training just on YouTube. And I just think for the person that asked me that question, you just got to, you know, use your common sense. Use Google, type something in. A lot of people want to be spoon-fed with training. A lot of people want to be great all of a sudden. You know, but it just takes practice. It takes grit. It takes determination. If you can't find the answer, keep looking. I'm trying to model this stupid motorbike at the moment. I started last July. And some of these pieces that take me weeks to finish because I can't find the reference images. I don't know what the piece is called even. And then I don't have any sort of guide images. So I have to just look at the image and try to work out how the model is supposed to work. The complicated pieces of of engineering, but you just got to keep at it. You know, people say to me, oh, I don't think I could do that. I haven't got the patience. Or, you know, how do you learn how to do that? You just do it and just practice, do it. You just got to have the determination. It was a bit of a rant, sorry.
No, I think JP can relate to that a little bit right now in your 3D journey, right? JP, I see your practice all the time. It's not for anything, but you're posting your modeling and your renders all the time, right? And you're just trying to get reps in.
Yeah, it all it all compounds, I think, too, is the big thing is it's repetition and, you know, getting the muscle memory. But it also comes back to the more times you use the same tools over and over again,
That's right.
Familiar you get with them. And the more when you run into a problem, you can start to kind of piece together how you can figure it out. And then if you don't, then you can, like John was saying, you go on to Google and try and, you know, fill the gap, I guess.
Yeah, well, ask someone. I mean, that's why Twitter's so valuable for me. But I run a Discord channel for 3D modeling, and that's handy as well. But I usually ask questions on Twitter because such a huge audience. I had a problem yesterday with something I was doing in Blender, and I got an answer back in a few minutes. So you need to surround yourself with people who are better than you, and you know, have people to ask, because that really helps.
Discord, yeah, that's another huge. Huge asset that the kids have nowadays that I never had growing up or none of us had growing up is there are just so many communities on Discord that usually like a creator like yourself, you know, will be a part of and will answer, but also it's a community of other, you know, like-minded people who are there to help answer your question too. I always think it's like a, I'm going to date myself here, but you probably remember what IRC is back in the day. Discord reminds me a lot of IRC, the chat client, mm-hmm. only way better. You know, for that type of instant feedback. Whereas, you know, back in the day, the thought of me like asking Andrew Kramer, emailing him a question, or Aaron Rabinowitz, you know, even though I'm sure they would have answered me, there was a lot of hesitation in that because it was a barrier there. Whereas now,
yeah,
a lot of those barriers have been broken down, and most people like yourself are happy to answer questions. And there's never such a thing as a dumb question, because there's honestly not a lot of gatekeeping. In the creative community, people are usually pretty helpful and willing to help out anybody.
It can get overwhelming though. It can be, you know, you can get flooded with stuff. If you're following Discord and Twitter and stuff, you've got to be really, really cherry pick the kind of people you follow, the kind of conversations you get involved in, the channels that you follow. It's very easy to get overwhelmed with a tsunami of stuff. And I think that can be really deflating. I keep mine very specific. My Twitter is always only about creative. It's only about either music, art, 3D or motion graphics. There's never anything personal there. Although, you know, I might have slipped up a couple of times when the previous president was in power. But overall, it's very, very focused. And the Discord channel is just 3D modeling with a little bit of texturing and rendering in there. But also to sort of continue on with what you were saying about things being available and people being available. I, on Discord now, when I'm working in my spare time modeling, I stream it. I don't let everyone on Twitter know that, but I'm streaming. So anyone on the Discord channel can log in and chat with me. So I get a couple of guys from India logging in the afternoons and just beginners in 3D, just asking me questions, and I can look at their screen, I can answer their questions, and I've just got music on in the background, I'm just working on my stuff. So people like me who share. This is what we do because we enjoy. I mean, I'm sitting in this room, it's dark. I've been working by myself for the last, 5-6 years as a freelancer in a room by myself. So COVID didn't make a huge difference to my lifestyle as far as interactivity, but I think that's because I interact online. It's important to have a community, people you can chat with, people you can, voice chat with, but also, you know, share your cameras and stuff like that. I think that's what keeps me sane. And sharing is part of that. It's me doing a live stream every Saturday and letting people, you know, drop into the Discord and chat with me live, or, you know, ask questions on YouTube. Just to be part of the community and interact. I think now more than ever, that's really important. But it can get overwhelming, I think, especially for a beginner.
I want to go back to something that you had mentioned. I think it's interesting that you're calling out that you just recently bought training, 5 to 6 hours of training, because you yourself do training, but you know that there's stuff that you don't know. So it's not that you feel like you have to know everything or have the presence of mind to say, okay, well, I don't know this. I need to go talk to somebody who's better at this than me. How, when people are learning different parts of motion design, how do you recommend that they attack it?
Well, I bought that training specifically because it was well marketed, because it was some Blender training for the experienced artist. I was looking, because I switched from Cinema 4D to Blender, and I wanted something that was longer form, that covered everything that I need to know as an experienced artist to make that switch. And it was really useful. I watched the whole thing. Didn't watch the second part of it where you actually build something, because by then I had enough skills just to get on with my own jobs, my own projects. But it was very specifically marketed to someone like me, and that was effective. I did learn a lot of stuff on YouTube, but this was good training. I'll never be afraid of buying training if it, you know, if it answers a specific need that I have. I won't spend too much on training though. You know, it's got to be, I'm not going to spend hundreds of dollars on training courses. You've got to really want to be, really want that training. And some training isn't marketed very well. They won't give you example videos of what it looks like. So you've got to be careful. I had two parts that I wanted to answer that question. The first was what training I buy. The second was,
yeah,
I like to see what's out there. So, and this gets back to social media. It's following specific channels or specific people on Twitter. You know, I follow Adobe, follow Maxon, follow you know, some other influencers, and see what's out there. Not because I'm going to buy it and watch it straight away, but because I'll know if I need to do that specific thing, then I can go to that specific place. So I think a lot of it has to do with knowing where to find the answers and then grab that nugget when you need it. You know what I mean? Because otherwise it's too overwhelming. I've got, you said before, you've got training you haven't watched. I've got training I haven't watched. And don't try and learn everything and remember everything. Just grab the bit you need when you need it. But I think the biggest thing is don't make the same mistakes twice. Don't make that mistake when you're working in the software and then not record how you fixed it. If I'm doing something specific and there's a specific checkbox, for example, I was doing something in Substance Painter where I was working with anisotropic textures, and it would always add a seam, a little seam where the texture met start and the end point. And I did a tutorial on it. I asked the substance team why, dug right down into it, did a bug report, couldn't find the answer anywhere. And this went on for a couple of years. And then I was chatting with someone on Twitter, and someone said, in RedShift, just check this box. And I was doing a watch project in my spare time for a client. It was a high-end watch, you know, wristwatch, and it needed anisotropic textures. And I was sending in the texture, and you could see a seam in it. And I was trying all these different workarounds, and then I was told to check this checkbox in RedShift, and it immediately fixed it. It just, the problem went away. It looked fabulous, and it was like, you know, the clouds opened up, the God rays came down, you know, the angels sang, everything was fixed. But if you don't record that and remember what you did, and then you go back next time and you can't work it out, that's just stupid. So I think it's understanding, you know, where to solve a problem when you need it, but also recording and remembering what you did. Get a OneNote page with all the little things that you learn. You know what I mean? Or all the little, you know, if you do need to, you think you might need to be able to do something later, record where those tutorials are, or, you know what I mean? Or use bookmarks or something like that. That's the way I do it. Like, otherwise you get, it's a tsunami of training and information, and it can get, so difficult that you just give up.
For me, I feel like it's way more fun when you get better at something. Is that the case for you? Is that how you've continued to go diving deep into rabbit holes?
Yeah, absolutely. When I first started in the industry, 3D wasn't motion graphics. They were different. You could literally go to a presentation. Macromedia had a piece of software called Extreme 3D. And, you know, I remember seeing that and how exciting that was to me. But then there was Adobe and Motion Graphics. There wasn't anything that joined the two. It was only when Cinema 4D, you know, came to the fore years later introduced MoGraph that people started to realize that as a motion graphics artist, you could use 3D. But even back in those very early days, something about 3D modeling appealed to me. I don't know why. The idea of building something in 3D. So I went through all the years of motion graphics and then was introduced to Cinema 4D probably 15 years ago and started to sort of dabble a little bit of that in Foxtel. And then, you know, a little bit of modeling here and there, real simple parametric object stuff. But then it had been years since I'd done motion graphics, so I was ready to really focus on something. And 3D is a huge area. You know, you've got so many different things you can focus on, rigging and hair and cloth and texturing and lighting. And I wanted to get really good at modeling. I decided that like 10 years ago, I just want to really focus in on modeling. So I just learned everything I could about Cinema 4D modeling and started to become a little more expert at that. And even now, just switching over to Blender, there's so much more to learn and also to transition the tools across from one to the other and understand how to do it in Blender. It's a never-ending quest. I just want to get better and faster and just model more and more complicated things because I just want to be really good at one thing. I think it's fun to, as you said, it's fun to be and it's exciting to be good at one thing. I can still do the other stuff, no problem, but it's just nice to focus. I really enjoy the focusing and it's good to share stuff and people go, wow, how did you do that? I enjoy that. It's a buzz.
We've talked a lot about, you know, where the industry and the software was, where it's at now with you and being at Boris now, especially where do you see the industry moving to, you know, whether that's software related or just industry wide related, where do you think the trends and the technology is moving? I know, big question.
That's a really interesting question, actually. Yeah. Sorry to cut you off there. It's an interesting question. Well, let's look at some of the more recent things that are happening in software. Last week, Adobe became a gold sponsor of Blender. And no matter what you think of that, it's very interesting that a company that has shareholders would invest in a company that says not that everyone says can never be bought. So it's a chess game, and I think Maxon bought Red Giant. Interesting because the 3D software bought, you know, one of the highest end motion graphics plugin developers on the planet. That's very interesting. So it is a huge chess game. Very difficult to keep track of. Adobe bought Substance Painter, you know? Yeah. So, from a high level, I think it's very interesting how, even if you're invested in a piece of software and you learn all about it, look at things like Shake, for example. It got bought by Apple and then it got terminated. You know, you can't be too invested in any software, I don't really think. I think it's better to understand overall technique. I think, you know, understand if using 3D modeling as an example, being a good 3D modeler isn't just about knowing the software. Most of it is knowing the modeling techniques that transcend the software. I personally switched from Cinema 4D to Blender because Blender's free. And I don't use a lot of Cinema 4D or basically none in the paid work that I do, only for Boris effects. And for myself, I don't want to upgrade anymore. And Blender's been very interesting over the last couple of years, how much it's developed. So, you know, I personally just switched to Blender. And I'm less likely to invest my money in more subscriptions and more software subscriptions. I hear more and more people talking about they've got just, you know, subscription overload, way too many things to juggle. It's harder to make a buck. And it made more sense for me because I do a lot of my modeling in my spare time just to use a piece of software that's free. And surprisingly, very, very good, which made the choice pretty simple. I don't know, as far as other people are concerned, I guess there's monetary considerations, there's their client considerations. Are you working for clients that need files, that use certain pieces of software? Do you need to learn that software? You know, do people want, I had a lot of people wanting me to deliver stuff in Octane. I don't use Octane. Thankfully, those clients switched to Redshift, so I was able to supply it in Redshift. I think you learn the pieces of software you need to learn to help you make a living. Don't get caught up using trying to learn pieces of software that don't actually develop into revenue generation, unless it's something like Blender, which is free. There's nothing to lose.
Can we dive in a little bit more to what you're doing with Boris? I think people probably heard Sapphire, maybe if they have effects plugins more so than most other things, but they also are home to BCC, Boris Continuum. They have Mocha, just a whole bunch of suite of tools that have now been functioned under Boris FX that were GenArts before, you know, different from different companies as well. So can you give us a little background on what Boris does and what your role there is?
Yeah, sure. So Boris FX is pretty much one of the founding third-party plugin developers for After Effects. Boris was there at the beginning, pretty much. Continuum is one of those, was the Boris FX flagship product. But over the years, Boris made some pretty canny investments, first being to purchase Mocha and Imagineer Systems and the software that Imagineer Systems was developing, and brought the team across. And, you know, anyone who's used Mocha for planar tracking will understand the power of that piece of software. And then a few years later, purchased Sapphire from GenArts. So also, that was an interesting purchase because Continuum and Sapphire have some crossover as far as tools. Less, I think once you really dig into it, you can see the difference between the two. I'm doing a lot of tutorials currently that use both, you know, Sapphire and Continuum, and I'm enjoying having both because it gives me more flexibility. But so with that and also Silhouette, which was one of the most recent purchases for rotoscoping, it's a pretty wide range of tools to cover pretty much everything you need for VFX and motion graphics.
So as part of your role on the marketing team to amplify those products and when they're released and highlight and use tutorials to help people understand how they can use them and implement those into their work.
Absolutely. Yeah, this was an ideal role for me. I'd been doing some work for Boris FX for a number of years before I joined the team. And I'd known Boris for years and, you know, known the team at GenArts for years and also Imagineer Systems for years. And we'd also met at NAB and I'd presented at NAB. So it was to be offered the role as head of motion graphics for Boris FX was like a hand in glove fit because of all of my years of working in broadcast motion graphics, my understanding of marketing, having my own company, and also all of the training that I did and do. So it was a perfect fit. So I currently work across most of the tools, mostly Continuum and Sapphire. And part of Continuum is like Particle Illusion and Tidal Studio. And my role is to record tutorials. So literally I sit here with the music on in my office and I create something. I'll just, as if I'm actually sitting in Foxtel creating a promo for a broadcast spot. But I'll use specifically Sapphire, Continuum and Boris FX tools. So I really focus in on those tools. In the past, I could go across any tool. And it was always a difficult juggle to know which tool to use and also to do a tutorial, you know, which piece of software do I focus on. But now I'm very focused on just Boris FX so I can really milk the best out of the tools and really explore the tools and find things I didn't know I could do and could be done and then roll that, you know, craft that into a tutorial and that goes onto the channel. And I did a thing recently where I did a whole workflow for the Mortal Kombat Dragon. So I modeled the dragon in Cinema 4D and I unwrapped it in Ryzen UV and textured it in Substance Painter and then brought that across to After Effects and comped that up using Sapphire. So not being afraid to use tools across, you know, a wide spectrum, not even, not just BorisFX tools. I think that's important too. And I'm glad I can do that. And I'm glad BorisFX is flexible enough to allow me to do that, because that's a logical way to teach. If you're just saying our tools are the best, don't use any others, then it's not a lot of legitimacy for that kind of approach. But I think if you say, here's what I think is the best workflow, then I think your tools make a lot more sense when you're explaining it across, you know, multiple products. So I sit in front of the screen, build stuff, record tutorials. When we have new releases, I will test those out, make bug reports, and I will create new graphic looks based on using the new tools. For example, Particle Illusion was updated recently with new 3D features. So I'd literally sit in here and, you know, I couldn't think of a better job. Just be creative and be paid for it. It's a perfect fit for me. And then just teach what I did. So I did 5 or 6 different looks for Particle Illusion, for example. And I was like, that can be a tutorial. That can be a tutorial. And I just went through and recorded 3 of them into, you know, 20, 30 minute tutorials on how to do that. So that's my main role now. So pretty much what I did at Foxtel, but ultra focused on Sapphire products, on BorisFX products.
Sounds like you get quite the leeway to play and experiment and find out different things that you could use to incorporate into tutorial. How much have you learned through that play in order to find some things that, as you were just saying, you didn't realize were even capabilities from the different presets plugins?
A lot, because I'm not necessarily going in and saying, okay, for this I'm going to use, you know, I'm going to use Sapphire Glow, Ultra Zap, and one other effect. I'm not necessarily doing that. Sometimes I will. I'll say I need to do some stuff using, say, Ultra Zap in Sapphire. But in order to develop that look, I'm digging through all of the other effects. And Sapphire is great because I can use Sapphire Effect Builder. So I can apply Ultra Zap, for example, and then I can go into the Effect Builder interface and I can literally just drop other effects on there really quickly. And I am literally doing that. I'm adding a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Ooh, that looks good. Or, ooh, that's too much. You know what I mean? And it's not like a color by numbers approach. It really is a sort of, you know, little bit of a taste test, a little bit of spice here, a little bit of that there. And I think I've been able to do that because of years of doing that. I don't think everyone, especially beginners, can necessarily do that. They're not really sure what they're looking for. And they often overdo it. They put way too much of something in. A typical example is way too many rays, putting like volumetric rays on something, or way too oversaturated. There's no real sense of finesse. So I get a chance to not only use lots of different effects, but also to finesse it in a way that is cohesive and makes sense. So yeah, I get wide scope to do that. No one really tells me what to do. My role is to get in there and be creative with it, to use it in certain ways. I mean, even in Sapphire Effect Builder, there's thousands of presets there. There's 600 of presets of mine, 600 presets in Sapphire Effect Builder. If you type in John in the search, you'll see all the presets I've created. And most of those were created while I was still working at Foxtel. So I was making stuff while I was working in broadcast graphics for television, using a piece of software that we use at Foxtel, and creating presets. So I think, oh, I can use that. I can use that. So then when I went to do an actual job, I'd look up my preset and just drop it on, because I wasn't just creating anything. And there's some bad presets out there in some software. But I was creating very specific things that I think were going to be useful. Now, I like using Sapphire Bokeh Lights, for example, which is, you know, soft bokeh lights. But if you make them small enough, you can make like little floating dust and stuff like that. With enough time and determination, you can do pretty much anything you need. So it's a lot of fun.
When it comes to sports motion graphics, there's a lot of energy that you infuse into the graphics. When you're talking about effects, how would you approach finding the right balance? You were just talking about not throwing too many effects at something, which you see a lot happen when people are early in their careers trying to make it look a little bit better. What's that approach to try and find the right mix?
It's interesting, actually, because hold that question, because I might have to repeat it in a sec. But I'm now talking about sports, just getting back to Foxtel, the job that I got at Foxtel was a 3-month contract to launch the Fox AFL channel in Sydney. This was, you know, this was 20 years ago. So the Fox Footy channel, it was a 3-month contract. Just, and we had to create graphics for all kinds of shows, and some of them didn't even get created, the shows. We created all these title sequences and stuff for shows that didn't ever exist. But that was my first step into real, fully fledged, you know, motion graphics broadcast environment. I was working on sports graphics. And I was into sport. Still am now, not as much as I was then, but you know, motion graphics and sport go so well together because sport's so dynamic. Right. So it's called motion graphics, right? So not many sports that actually where people stand still. So you definitely my a very solid grounding in sport for motion graphics. And you know, cut to now. And I don't think anything's really changed as far as my approach. I think, and it doesn't really matter if it's sports or whatever it is, you've got to understand what's the story you're trying to tell. You know, you might have an edit that you've done or an editor's given you. Mostly for me, it would be one of the primary producers cut something together. What are they trying to say? And what are they trying to say in the edit? And how can the graphics enhance that? You know what I mean? So you would not say, you wouldn't say, someone wouldn't give you a cut and tell you, you need to use these two effects. You know, it's like, sometimes they'll say, oh, I like this particular look, or here's some examples of stuff that I think would work well with this. They wouldn't tell you to be, you know, specifically use certain effects. Mostly it's create that look and feel using whatever effects you know how to use, or whatever effects you can, you know, whatever tools you can use to create that look. But it's all about the story, right? It's all about what you're trying to say with that spot, and also what you're trying to focus on. You know, do you cut the talent, you know, or the sports person, the player out of the shot, and then treat them so that they become the focus? Or you know, do you put graphics all over only on one side of the shot and text on the other? It just depends on how the shot was shot. You know, it all depends on the footage that you're working with and the story that you want to tell.
Yeah, that's great. If you're talking to people who are getting into it or have a video background, have your pharmaceutical background, who are cutting pieces together in some software and they want to add motion graphics more intimately as part of their content, what advice would you give them to get into it?
I would say keep it simple to start with. And don't fall into the trap of just using looks because everybody's using that look. I think really importantly is understand typography. You know, dead giveaway for bad graphics is bad typography, bad kerning. So really understanding, you know, yeah, leading, kerning, how to make your text look really good, font choice. You know, it's the old Comic Sans papyrus issue. You know, choose a font that matches the footage that you're working with. You know, is it a dynamic font? Is it oblique? Meaning, is it slanted? You know, slanted text has more motion in it. If you get the right font, then is that font going to be animated? Is the animation going to match the shot? Is the text going to sit in front or behind a player? Maybe you want to do a bit of rotoscoping and cut the arm of a, you know, maybe if a basketballer, for example, is bouncing a ball, maybe you want to rotoscope the ball so the text can move behind the ball. So then the text is integrated into that shot. So how can I use motion graphics and visual effects to integrate the motion graphics? If it's a particle, particle stream, for example, in our case, we'd use particle illusion. Is that moving in 3D behind that rotoscope player? You know, is that going to add more energy to the shot? So even if it's just a beginner, it's the same answer. How can I use motion graphics to enhance my message before, you know, I think that's the question you ask before you even think about, you know, what tools you would even use. And it's an experienced editor who knows how to tell a story, I think, could answer that question quite easily. I know that promo producers that I worked with often had pretty good ideas about what they wanted motion graphic wise. Not that they could necessarily create it themselves, but they generally have some ideas about how, when they're actually cutting the spot, they're thinking about the motion graphics. You know what I mean? You wouldn't just cut a spot and then think, okay, now let's add some motion graphics without having given any thought. You know, shot choice is really important in motion graphics. Because if you're, like I said, again, if you want to cut someone out, you know, are they fully in the frame? Are their legs cut off? You know, does the arm go out of frame? Are you going to scale them down? If you scale them down and their arm goes out of frame, then what are you going to do? You're going to rebuild their hand? You know, it's considering how the footage works in with the motion graphics. As far as getting into motion graphics for an editor, getting back to what I said at the beginning is keep it really simple. Understand typography and get the basics right first before you start going too complicated.
And if anybody didn't understand any of the terms he just used, I think John gave you advice earlier on what you should do. Use Google. Brought it home there. Wrap it back around.
Right.
He gave you some homework.
Right.
There you go. Go learn what kerning and lutting and all that different stuff is for typography.
I have one final question that's probably mostly off topic, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Sure.
I went to your Twitter right before this. I thought I had already followed you on Twitter from a while ago, but I hadn't. So I followed you on Twitter. Wow. When you follow somebody on
That's
Twitter,
terrible.
It shows you.
Inexcusable.
I know, it's terrible. I've watched your stuff on YouTube. I've been on your YouTube for a while now. But I just now followed you on Twitter. And it says followers you know, right? People you follow and mutual followers. I want to know if you knew that Andrew WK follows you. And if so, why does Andrew WK follow you? Or were you unaware?
So are you talking about Andrew Kramer?
No, Andrew WK, the musician. I'm telling you
Andrew
something
WK.
You don't know.
Okay. Yeah, you are telling me. So what, does follow me or doesn't follow me?
He
or?
Does follow you. It's a mutual follower we have in common who follows you, which I found very interesting.
Okay. Well, I'm gonna hold up the age card here, and I'm sorry, Andrew W. No. But I'm not sure who Andrew WK is.
Oh wow, I was really hoping there was gonna be a. Like, oh, you don't know who Andrew WK is, JP? Oh man, Andrew WK. I don't know how to describe him.
Let me have a quick look. I'm gonna look this up as well.
He's a punk singer. Yeah, Party Hard is like the song he's really really known for. But he's a wild dude. He's an absolutely.
Oh, right, okay.
Andrew WK is his name. Yeah, Andrew Kramer was on that list. I expected that. Andrew WK. I was not quite expecting. Maybe Andrew WK is a motion graphics, maker in his spare time, and he wants to learn and follows your stuff. But I thought,
that probably is the case, you know, because you know, Deadmau5 is a big Cinema 4D user, right?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean that's cool. Yeah. I'm happy to have anyone follow me that's into the same stuff.
Dang it. Well, I thought that was going to be a really, really unique and interesting story of like, oh, yeah.
I should have said, yeah, we're mates from way back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Well, either he's not watching his Twitter, either he's not watching his Twitter stream or he's really into modeling motorbikes because I haven't been tweeting much other than that recently.
It could be.
Maybe he's into Indian Scout motorbikes, you know, could be.
Well, thank you so much for making Creative Sports Podcast part of your day. We'd love to hear your thoughts, feedback, and suggestions, so pop on over to the sports creative community on Slack and connect with us and your fellow creatives. If you're enjoying this podcast, we'd love it if you shared it with a friend or a coworker and leave us a 5-star rating so other people will be able to find us as well. And don't forget to subscribe so that you're the first person to catch each new episode. Remember, the world needs your voice, so keep creating.
Well, kerning is the space between two letters. Tracking is the space between all letters. And letting is the line space between the base lines of text. I learned all that when I did that computer graphics college course. You know, that was years ago, but still useful.